Hello, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our topic is arts work. Who gets the job? I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Many of our programs have podcasts on the web that you'll be able to listen to in a few days. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel that's going to be speaking on this subject, and they are all local stars. Kenneth Foster, to my far left, is Executive Director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, or YBCA. It's a multidisciplinary contemporary arts center right just a couple blocks away in downtown San Francisco. Ken joined YBCA in 2003. Prior to joining that organization, he served as Executive Director of UA Presents at the University of Arizona, Professor and Director of the Center for Performing Arts at Pennsylvania State University, and Managing Director at the Kirkland Arts Center in Illinois, and is Executive Director at the Town Hall Arts Center in, I forgot the name of the town, Colorado.
Littleton, Colorado.
He's also served on the boards of the Association of Performing Arts Presenters, Dance USA, and Chamber Music America, among others. Ken has a BA from Metropolitan State College and an MA from New York University. His first book, Performing Arts Presenting, From Theory to Practice, was published in 2006. In the middle is Grace Stanislaus. Grace is the Executive Director of the Museum of the African Diaspora, or MOAD, in downtown San Francisco, almost across the street from the Center for the Arts. Before coming to the MOAD, Grace was previously at the Studio Museum in Harlem as a curator. She was also president and CEO of the Romare Bearden Foundation in New York, and she was executive director of the Bronx Museum of the Arts and of the Museum for African Art in New York, senior vice president of the August Wilson Center for the Performing Arts in Pittsburgh. She has an MA in art history from Columbia University and a bachelor's in art history from Fordham University. And she's also completed the leadership training program of the Museum Management Institute at the Getty Museum. She's currently on the board of the California Association of Museums. Clay Lord is Director of Communications and Marketing for Theater Bay Area. Theater Bay Area is a service organization for theater arts and audiences in Northern California. Clay is also the editor of Counting New Beans. He joined theater, about which we will speak somewhat this evening. He joined Theater Bay Area in 2005 and has led the audience development and research programs at the organization, including the Bay Area Big List, Free Night of Theater, and the Data Point Research Program. He also sits on the Oversight Committee for Project Audience and is a blogger. And he has a BA from Georgetown University. We'll be hearing different views from the perspective of leadership in performing and or visual arts about the issues, challenges, and yes, solutions for people seeking work in the nonprofit arts world. So let's begin with Clay. Each of our panelists will speak for a few minutes and then about from the perspective of his organization, his or her organization, then move on, or I'll help you move on.
You'll help us move
on. Or I'll ask a question. And they are free to question each other, and then we'll open it up about between 20 of and quarter of 7 for your questions. Okay? Clay? flight would you like to begin?
Sure. Thank you, Anne, and the Commonwealth Club for having me here tonight. This is a real honor, and I'm very excited. Anne is also on the board of Theater Bay Area as well and has been a board member at Theater Bay Area for a very long time. Many years. How about that? So as Anne was mentioning, I work for Theater Bay Area. We are a service organization, a nonprofit service organization, that our mission is to support theater and dance artists and organizations here in the Bay Area. The actual words are unite, strengthen, promote, and advance. And so the question of who gets the job or what the job sector for theater artists is going to look like in the future is near and dear to our hearts and is also something we spend a whole lot of time worrying about. I wanted to start by telling you about two actors. They are both actors who, if you go to a lot of theater in the Bay Area, you know them. I'm not going to tell you who they are, but they are some of the most prolific actors in the Bay Area. They both work about 50 weeks of every year doing and creating art. And one of them is a barista at Starbucks, and the other is a postal worker. These are the people who, if anyone had a right to actually make a living as an actor in the Bay Area, it would be these two, and they simply cannot make ends meet without having another job. We live in a country where the NEA's annual budget is about $170 million, a little less than that. That's about half of what we spend on any given day when we're at war. And yet, our Republican presidential nominee is interested in entirely slashing that budget. And we generally have a culture that doesn't value art, that doesn't value culture, interestingly, and that doesn't believe that the government should support it. So a lot of what we spend our time on when we're thinking about what's going to happen to all of these artists, these 3,000 working artists that we support through our membership programs, is what's going to happen to them if the sector completely dies, which, of course, it won't actually completely die. That's hyperbolic. But if we continue down the road that we've been on for the last 30 years, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Because the only reason that the government can actually get a whole bunch of people riled up about a $170 million program, given the size of their budget, is because over the past 30 years, for a variety of different reasons, a whole lot of people have grown up not caring about the arts. They've grown up without a lot of access to arts and culture, whether that's theater or dance or museums or music. And they are doing just fine, or so they think. And so when you have a conversation with them about whether they should support the arts, whether the government should support the arts, whether they, through the government, should support the arts, they say, why don't I just get to keep that money? I don't understand what art does for me. And for us, that is a direct line back to jobs. And it's also a direct line back to this book, which is Counting New Beans. It's called Counting New Beans, Intrinsic Impact and the Value of Art. And it's actually out in the lobby. Anne made me bring some copies, even though it embarrassed me. So they're out in the lobby for sale if you want them. But it's a book that has taken us about 2.5 years to put together. And it's about impact, about the impact of art on the individual. And in a larger way, it's about relevance. And relevance for us gets directly back to the health of the sector. So just to give you the brief overview of what intrinsic impact means, for us, intrinsic impact is measuring the intellectual, emotional, empathetic power of art, the impact of the art on the individual, using standard metrics and a common vocabulary. So another way of putting that is if you go to see a great show, if you go to see a great piece of theater, or if you go to hear an incredibly impactful piece of music, something happens to you. But if you try to describe what happened to you, and we know this because we did a bunch of interviews with patrons and we asked them about the most impactful arts experience they've ever had, even the most articulate people are often rendered inarticulate when asked to describe why a piece of art impacted them or how a piece of art impacted them. They can say that they were changed. They can begin to cry. They can have strong emotional reactions. But if you ask them to actually articulate it, you can get into some trouble. Where this becomes problematic, because in a way it's great, it demonstrates exactly how wonderful art can be, but where you get into trouble is when you start having conversations with the people who are funding this community, whether you're talking about audience members or, as is more germane right now, when you're talking about government or private foundation funders. When you try and explain that the impact of a piece of art is that it renders people inarticulate, it's not quite what they're going for. On the other side, if you talk to artists about how they know that a piece of art is impacting the world and impacting the audience members that see it, a lot of them will basically say, I watch people watch the art and I just know that it's impacting them. And they don't mean that with any sort of glibness. If you've worked in the field for 2 decades, 3 decades, if you're the artistic leader of a major arts organization, then you absolutely know that if you sit in a dark room and you listen to the sounds of the room while people are watching a piece of theater, you know whether it's landing or not. You know whether it's impacting people. The problem is that you run into the same conversation then, because if that person tries to go speak to the funders and he basically says, you got to trust me, we really were impacting all these people, I know because I sat there and I listened to them breathe, that's not something that is a terribly articulate conversation to be having. And so what we're trying to do, and again, bringing it back to this idea of increasing the support and health of the sector, and in a longer-term way, increasing the relevance of the sector and the ability of the arts sector, but specifically the theater sector, to say we are relevant and you should be attending this, is we're trying to actually quantify the impact of art. So what we did was we worked with a research firm called Wolf Brown, and they had developed a series of questions. There are about 80 questions, of which each arts organization that participated was able to choose 30. We surveyed about 19,000 people across the country, 6 cities. These are people who had attended a theater event and were immediately after asked to fill out this survey. And these questions were questions that were designed to allow us to actually quantify how intellectually impacted they were, how emotionally impacted they were, how socially impacted they were, whether that's social bonding, which is basically confirming who they are culturally, socially, familially, or social bridging, which is allowing them to see the wider world that is out there, which is, of course, one of the major things that art can do. We worked with all of these 18 theaters across the country in order to do this surveying, with the express goal of trying to get a large enough sample size that we could then do all sorts of manipulations with it and understand what the impact of theater, generally speaking, was. And one thing we figured out is that that's really hard to do because every piece of theater is different to every individual. So basically, in a way, we had 19,000 experiences of 19,000 different pieces of art. And at the same time, there is a core common understanding. And you can look and see that this avant-garde show is very intellectually stimulating, and this production of Mamma Mia is not intellectually stimulating, but is highly socially stimulating. And that both of those things are great, and both of those things are valuable. And if you take that data and you pair it with anecdote, and you pair it with the stories that we love to tell, and that we always fall back on, then you have a stronger case that can be made, whether you're talking about funders or government officials or individual donors. When we talk about impact, as I said, it's very difficult. We rely on, in a way, if you're inside the field, you rely on jargon. So you start talking about lift. You talk about captivation. In the case of one person that we interviewed that's a patron, he started talking about the tingle that runs through his body whenever he sees a great show. And he basically says he knows it's not going to happen always, and he knows it might not even happen always, but he hopes it happens often enough that he wants to go back again, which is basically like a drug addiction or a sex addiction. And that's great because, in a way, that's the kind of perpetuation that we want. That's the model, is that these are people who understand that this is doing something fundamentally valuable to you. I was speaking this morning to some people at the NEA, and at one point there was a conversation. Oh, the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts. This is the organization that's constantly under threat that has a $170 million budget. And I was speaking to them this morning about this research, and at one point one of the people got up and started asking me about another study that has been floating around from the University of Michigan that was basically research looking into goosebumps, tingles on the skin. And it was looking at how music instigates goosebumps. And one of the reasons that this is important is that goosebumps are kind of a leftover reflex from back when we were lizards. And goosebumps are a fight or flight response. They're this tingling. It's the raising of the hair on the skin in order to make you look scarier, and it's this. It comes along with all of these other things: shortness of breath and tightening of your innards, and rush of blood to the inside of the body that are designed to heighten your ability to either fight or flee. And the only other places where goosebumps occur are around things that are fundamental to perpetuating the species. So incredibly good food or love, sex, things like that. And then there's art. And one of the things that was so fundamental about that study and so interesting about it is that art is not considered a fundamental in the United States. But in this biologically based way, it's clear to see that it is. And so how can we have a conversation that allows for that to be what people understand?
And then I'd ask the question,
yeah.
How can we also say to the theater maker, you know, does that influence what I do for programming or how many people I need to hire for the next play or, you know, how many designers I need?
Right.
And so on.
So, yeah. I mean, I think when it comes down to jobs, what we're actually really concerned about, and this will be my close, is that you can't have jobs in a sector that no one supports. And that the reason that people are finding it difficult to support the sector is because we haven't done a very good job of explaining to them why we should. And so perhaps over the course of the next few years, as we continue this work and as it gets picked up by our field, which is starting to happen now, we'll be able to have more of a conversation about increased attendance and about what we're actually doing and about how people who might think that the doors of the theater are closed to them actually have something to find inside. Thank you.
Great. And Grace, from the museum perspective, what would MOAD say about intrinsic impact and also how that relates to the work that you do and the jobs that are there?
Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to participate on this panel. First of all, I just wanted to start with a quote that I read online. This is the quote. I have a hankering to be paid very little for the rest of my life. Does anyone have feedback on the best arts administration programs in the country, the world? Now, this person has the advantage of three critical insights. One is that the reality on the ground of the salaries of nonprofit arts and cultural workers should give us pause, especially in a society that has more barriers than ever to economic success, however you define it in a post-middle-class world. The second is that an arts administration or an MBA degree is a valuable asset to have these days. If you aspire to run nonprofit cultural organizations, because they are complex businesses that require knowledge about tax laws, fundraising, financial accounting, management, governance, human resources, marketing, and let's not forget running museum store retail operations. And third, the real hankering that this person feels, which is expressed by the interest in plowing forward, armed with the best education, despite having insight into the reality on the ground, is rooted in, at its heart, in an admirable desire to serve the common good. This defines the purpose of nonprofits and can offer to many, often those who still wear rose-colored glasses, a sense of purpose and a source of personal fulfillment that extends beyond the financial. This panel has intersected with a period of professional reflection on my 30 years of lived experience in a nonprofit cultural arena. And one realization, which I put in the category of should have hindsight, is that a degree in arts administration or MBA would have served me well if only I recognized early on my hankering was to run nonprofit cultural organizations. Years later, when that hankering emerged, I was able to supplement my expensive mainstream education by participating in the Getty Museum Institute program. The reason why I share my personal history is because in a lot of ways my career trajectory is a true case study in nonprofit focused interest over a long-term period. And this is important when I think about myself as, and I hope you don't mind my framing this in personal terms, because I think you can talk about studies, but we do the work that we do because we have a passion for it. We do the work that we do because it's valuable. And I realized as I sat in my classes at Columbia University, the only person of color, the only African-American, African-Caribbean woman of color, that my path was going to be very different. And so as I started my career at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and this was the early 80s, so I'm really dating myself now, I entered into that institution with the intention of being able to apply what I had learned in the darkened room of Columbia University to an underground reality that we, African-Americans or people of color, don't have the same access. So the conversation is a different conversation. And when I started my career, my conversation was about mainstreaming. And that for me meant, how do I access the mainstream cultural organizations, the galleries and the museums? How do I, with a master's degree in art history, have an opportunity to apply what I had learned in a mainstream environment? And at the time, that was the hallmark of success for someone like myself. I was, in essence, an anomaly. And so as I think about what museums and the institutions that I've served over the course of these 30 years, I think about a few factors, a few variables that have been powerfully impactful and important to consider. One is, as we have moved through trying to find the resources, and typically the institutions that I've been involved with have been community-focused, valuing local communities of color, essentially, mission-focused, ethnically specific in some cases. And as I thought about what the critical issues were, I realized that there were variables to my experience in running these organizations. So I started as curator, wanted to make the transition into applying what I'd learned to organizations as I moved into the next phase of my professional career. The factors that matter to nonprofits are the ones that we do not control, essentially. And for me, as I've looked back over the course of 30 years, the thing that I've realized is external factors like the funding philanthropic community. Let me give you the trajectory of my experience in relation to the philanthropic community. At one of my previous organizations, the focus at the time was on support for stabilization and for building staff. At another institution, and this meant that if you did not have that focus, your funding would either not be available or would end. Another was focused on building permanent collections. So at a certain juncture, we all swayed towards, how do we access these funds? How do we make sure that we are able to support that particular philanthropic focus? And so we got curators in-house. We made sure that we shored up in terms of our curatorial programs. At another organization, the focus was on education programs. And, of course, we would build the education department, build the programs, and in many cases, once that funding source or sources decided to move in another direction, our programs would have to end, or we would have to find the way to fill in the gap. At the underpinning of all of this is a constant destabilization of our nonprofit organizations, which has been at the heart of the challenge that we faced to build capacity and sustainability on an ongoing basis. So when I think about how I am able to staff up at under-resourced institutions for the most part, but valuable and important to the community, there are a number of variables. One is within the African-American community, and this was one of my specific focus early on in my career, we started to realize that there was not really a core group. We were not philanthropic at that point, understanding how to support arts and culture. There was really not a core group that valued art in the same way as today. We had a program at the Studio Museum, for instance, called it was focused on training African-Americans with wealth to become collectors. And so a part of our core purpose was to ensure that we had a base of ongoing support. And that base needed to come from our community, and that community was not really prepared at the time to support or sustain us. So the philanthropic community and the variables, having no base of support that came from within the community, at least early in my career, was another factor. What we did was ensure that the quality of the programs were high. We ensured that we had a good board always, building a strong core and representative board was at the heart of it as well. So when I think about how our institutions have struggled within the visual arts community to really build sustainability, and especially small to medium-sized organizations that are ethnically or community-based, there have been huge challenges. And I think about my career starting at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and one of the main questions was, how do we get the New York Times to review our exhibits? How do we get them to come to Harlem? And so geography was a factor. Our location was an issue. And as I think about the core issues that have faced our institutions as it's reflected in my career trajectory, I would say that this museum, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and I've been here now for almost 3 years, is an extraordinary and unique institution in many ways. And so when you think about the landscape in New York of organizations that are available, so many organizations, and you think about this one in San Francisco that offers a unique perspective. So the museum showcases the history, the art, and the cultural richness that resulted from the dispersal of Africans throughout the world. And in that framework of our mission, there are a number of key components. One is we focus on education, public programs, and education programs. We are looking to support artists through a new visual arts program initiative that we hope to launch. But we do support artists at all levels through our visual arts, literary, and performing arts program now. So we do have programs that bring artists in to present on panels. We do not have artists on staff, but what we do is have a plan that we hope to be able to build our programs to be able to support artists in their art making.
What skills do you find among staff that you hire? I was listening to you guys. I'm thinking of, does that mean that everybody on the staff has to have a museum or visual arts background?
I would say no. No, absolutely not. I think that people come with a lot of valuable experience. But in this day and age, museums, cultural organizations are businesses. And they absolutely require at all levels an understanding of how the business runs. When I started my career, it was enough that I had an art history degree, and my passion was the passion focused on the specifics of that institutional mission. Now, having gone through 30 years, I realized, and having gone through the Getty Management Leadership Training Program, it's evident that to sustain a business, to build capacity, long-term sustainability into our organizations, you really do have to come at it with either an arts administration degree or an MBA or even a law degree, because they're much more complex institutions to run now. And so I saw over the course of my 30 years, more people coming into the field, into museums, seeing that their transition from curator, as I did, to museum director, from educator to museum director, having to really supplement their education in order to actually effectively be able to run those businesses.
And is this true for entry-level people or people looking to make a change in their careers? I mean, if you were going to describe a couple of people on your staff, and their backgrounds, just kind of generically, say someone who is the salesperson, the key salesperson in the shop. Do they have retail experience?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, a part of what you need to do is to see this as a business that has business centers that need to thrive. We are relying on earned revenue to support our institutions. So we have a number of different revenue streams, and we have to ensure that each one has the right staff in place to ensure that it reaches the goals that set for the organization.
Yes.
Can I also? So that is very interesting, and we're seeing. We're seeing a similar trend in the theater and dance community, and what's interesting is that it's not just administrators. More and more frequently, we are seeing that individual actors, individual directors, individual designers have to have a business sense that is not innate to most artistic people. And so we've actually created a whole curriculum of classes that are run in part by experts who are from outside the arts and in part by experts who are inside the arts to actually train those people not in an official get-a-certificate way but in a more informal way to understand how to be both business people and artists. Okay. And I imagine that is true for you,
well,
too.
Well, it's absolutely true. And a part of the issue is that, you know, you have new legislation like the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation that requires you to be much more accountable than in the past. So you've got to be able to demonstrate by the numbers that you present to funders and, you know, others who are interested in your work that you are reaching your metrics and that you are competitive relative to others in the field. And so it's not enough now. It was enough when I started my career to come in with the passion and the knowledge of art history. And I will tell you that I flayed for many years. If I had had the insight that this person had that I quoted to you, you know, earlier, mm-hmm. where can I find that best degree, I would absolutely have gotten another career trajectory, which would have better prepared me for the business that I'm running now. And I just want to add one thing about the nonprofit business model. This is something that I've been thinking about for many years. I actually do not think that this model is working or effective. And one of the reasons that I think it needs to be reconsidered are the variables that have gone into this, one being that the foundation and corporate community can change direction while you are going in one track and you are doing well with the programs that you are running and, you know, all of the staff that you brought in to run those programs. You can be destabilized by the next cyclical reevaluation of their guidelines and their philanthropic focus.
Yes, and I'm sure I know it causes great frustration. And let's go on to an even more diversified institution, the Center for the Arts. Ken, who do you look for?
You know, it's tough when you're the last one, because you guys have said really profound, provocative things. I've been taking some notes here. So I want to attack this from a slightly different perspective, perhaps, and really get to the job situation. And I do that on the basis of the kind of institution that I run. So I'm the executive director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which is a contemporary multidisciplinary arts institution. That fights every day against its institutionality. I feel like we exist at a very interesting intersection of all of the contemporary trends that are happening in our world, not just in the arts, but in all aspects of American society, in fact, of international society. And that constantly challenges my thinking and the thinking of the people who work for YBCA about who we are, what we're doing, why we're doing it. And it addresses many of the issues that Clay and Geitz have already spoken about. So let me just say, kind of pull back a little bit and say, I too have been, I had no idea, 30 years. Me too, honey. that's a long time. The one part of my biography that Ann didn't include was that I was a high school teacher for 10 years. I come from a working class background. High school teaching was a way out of the working class into the middle class. And from there, I went into arts administration, and I followed what I would consider to be a very conventional career path in terms of becoming the executive director, first of a small nonprofit, then, as you heard, working in several universities. I'm 60-plus years old, and so I'm officially a baby boomer. And I have a particular worldview that says this is how one works, this is how one succeeds. And so all of this background came together around the kind of career path that I, too, followed in terms of seeking a position, a career position, and moving forward with that position, endlessly going for the bigger job, the better job, the higher salary, et cetera. But really understanding myself since 1982 as a career arts administrator. Currently, I have 50 full-time people who work for me and probably 20 or 30 more part-time people who work for me. And I am the minority in that organization for that particular point of view. So one of the big challenges for me and people in my position is what we're calling now the intergenerational workforce. So that those of us who have a particular value system are managing and working with people who have a completely different value system and a completely different view of how what success is and how one succeeds. They're sort of generically labeled the millennials, and I have a ton of them working for me. And for a long time, they just drove me crazy. Because I thought they were entitled and they didn't have the experience I had and they hadn't worked hard like I'd worked to get where I got, and they want the title and they want the money and they want the recognition, and like, honey, get down in the trenches and do the work like I did, then we'll talk about it. It took me a while and several different interactions with my staff to understand that I'm dealing with a different people with a different value system, and that actually that can work to the benefit of the organization. So, in fact, as a general rule, and of course these are all gross generalizations about boomers and millennials, but these are also people that are extremely dedicated, as Grace and Clay have both pointed out, extremely dedicated not only to their career and what they're about, but also to the very idea of art and what art is about. So almost without exception, everyone who works at YBCA is absolutely committed to art and the performance and the exhibition and the production and the presentation of art over everything else. So that sort of drives their motivation. What makes that particular generation different than me and my generation is that rather than viewing this through the lens of a career, they view this through the lens of a life. And what they're not interested in building a career as much as they're interested in building a life. So the first way that I encountered that was when employees would say things to me like, yeah, this is great, but, you know, I have a yoga class at 4:30 that I have to go to every day. No problem, right? And I'm like, what do you? I'm like, here at 8:30, I'm gone till 9 o'clock at night, and you want to go to your yoga class? So they're building a career, they're building a life, they're not building a career. And they understand their work in arts organizations as a multifaceted approach rather than the sort of single-directed approach that I took when I was growing up in this world. In 2008, we all know what happened in 2008-09, which is the rug got pulled out from under us. In so many different ways, certainly economically, but I have a whole rap that I won't give you about why it's much more than economics. But I think what that did is get the attention of all of us, and those of us that have been doing this for 30 years realize that this was not just yet another economic drift, yet another problem. This was a shift. There's a shift going on in the way we imagine our industry and the way we participate in the industry and the way that generation for whom this is part of their reality in a way that's different than mine, in the way that that makes different sense to them. So I think what we're looking at now in terms of jobs is my prediction, my sense of the environment is that the kinds of jobs that I have, that Grace has, that Clay have, are fewer and fewer and fewer. And what people are, if you're in your 20s and 30s and you're looking to participate in the nonprofit arts, you should be thinking about how you put different pieces together of different experiences to create your life. It's a much more entrepreneurial approach rather than the sort of industrial model that we grew up under. It's a much more entrepreneurial approach. It's like, I'm going to put different pieces of this together. And so instead of being a barista, probably one of those actors is all, in fact, I know, not necessarily the ones you're talking about, but that the people who work at Yerba Buena, we have a lot of part-time people who work there. We have people who work there full-time, but as soon as they're done, they're off doing something else. They're putting a life together. And I think rather than saying, suggesting to you that, you know, this is a career path that you might follow in order to be the executive director of an arts institution, I think, one, those jobs are getting fewer and fewer. Two, as Grace so eloquently pointed out, they are requiring an array of skills that, frankly, I have no interest in learning. I just really don't want to go there, right? So, you know, people always ask me, well, you know, I'm like, you know, I am running the most interesting organization that I have any interest in running. And I'm not interested in being the executive director or the CEO of a massive institution that has really focused on all of those things that Grace talked about. It's absolutely true. That is, fortunately, for those of you that are thinking about where I go from here, I think the opportunities exist in multiple different areas to create an artistic life, a life that's dedicated to art, that doesn't fall into this trap of being the executive director of a nonprofit arts organization and all of the business stuff that goes along with that. So what are the job opportunities? I think that for better or for worse, and I know this may sound like I'm putting my own trajectory down a little bit, and I'm not. I'm very happy with the life that I created for myself, and I love what I do, and I would wish that other people could have that opportunity. I just think realistically those opportunities are less likely to happen. So we're into this entrepreneurial age where everybody's, you know, there's 100 startups within a 3-block radius of YBCA. There are over 100 startups. I mean, we in San Francisco are right in the heart of this sort of surge of creative activity. People are creating, using their entrepreneurial skills to make their life. And I think that's what's happening in the arts as well. And it's much more likely that you'll be gainfully employed in some arts-related endeavor in that way than that you will, quote, unquote, get a job at an arts organization. They're not going away, but I think that there's a big shift happening.
So that's really the idea of a shift. Also means that there's opportunities. It also means there's changes in skills. We do have some questions, so
Right. So
let's go ahead and begin. We have about 15 minutes left of official time.
Can I just challenge Ken just a little bit? Well, not challenge, but ask a question.
Yes.
So,
sure.
So
different generations.
Well, and I think that I am one of those people who has made a life, and I am lucky to have a boss who has allowed me to do that. I live in Petaluma, which for those of you who don't know is an hour and 15 minutes north of here. I have a 19-month-old daughter. And I have basically allowed my boss to call or text me anytime as long as he lets me in the office at 10 and out of the office at 3:30 and off on Thursdays.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And I think
I rest my case. He's proving my point.
But here's the thing. I think that one of the things that says is that is not working less hard. It's simply working differently. And
right.
I think actually in a way, and of course I didn't, my parents both worked at IBM for 35 years. And I always thought that would be me. And for a long time I thought I would be a lawyer as opposed to an arts administrator. And boy, were they sad that day. But in a way, what's interesting to me about what you're saying is, and I don't disagree necessarily, but it is, I think it's always a little sunnier on the other side of the street. And I feel very lucky in that I seem to have managed to fall into a place where I have a whole lot of stability. I have insurance, I have vacation, I have a salary that can support me, and I also have a tremendous amount of flexibility. And I think that I'm lucky, and also that those jobs don't exist a lot. And so instead what you're looking at is a situation where people have to cobble together a lot of things, which I think you calling it making a life is great, and hopefully that's what it is. But I think in another sense it's also working 60 hours a week, 40 of which you're not doing art, and that you probably don't get insurance out of it either. And so that's really where we're, and I personally very particularly am concerned, is that I think that the arts ecosystem right now, Rocco Landisman, who's the head of the NEA, I guess last year, maybe the year before, caused a whole lot of energy and angst by saying that he felt like there was more supply than there was demand in the field. And that basically there were way too many organizations and way too many people trying to make art for the field to sustain all of those people. And I think that there's a true reality to that that's very hard for us to understand. And I wonder how that'll be addressed.
Well, so, yeah, I understand what you're saying. I actually profoundly disagree with Rocco on that point. What there is an oversupply of are artists and arts organizations who expect the world to behave the way it did 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That party's right.
Yes.
There is an oversupply of, well, I created a dance company. How come the NEA isn't supporting me? How come Alcorp? How come nobody's coming? I created it. I should get supported. I think that is absolutely true. But I think the idea, which is what I love about this sort of millennial approach, if you will, but the idea of how I understand myself as an artistic person in the world, it's much more expansive than having a job at the symphony or having a job at YBCA. That I understand myself as an artistic individual in all these different ways. And actually, I have a really full life. Even I actually like my barista job because, like, I don't have to think too much. I meet some interesting people. That I get my health insurance through Starbucks. I don't. I'm not. This is not my career path. It's a piece of my life. And for those of us who are career path oriented, that's a really hard thing to grasp. And I agree with you that I'm not valorizing that. I'm not saying hallelujah, it's like this. I'm saying this is the way the world is. This is where jobs are evolving too. Jobs in the arts are evolving too. I think Grace said it, and I think it's absolutely right that we are that nonprofit model that we bought into is dying or is having a hard time. And I don't think that's the future. I don't think it's going to go away, but I don't think that's the future.
I just add one thing, if I can.
I'm Ann W. Smith, the chair of the Club's Arts Forum, and we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Arts Work, panel with Ken Foster, Clay Lord, and Grace Stanislaus. Grace?
I'm really glad that Ken frame this up in terms of generational issues, you know, that I am a pre-internet age person in the post-internet world, you know. I mean, I didn't have cell phones. I didn't, you know, all of that stuff when I started my career. And, you know, I didn't have 403B plans or 401K plans. We didn't even talk about retirement. We didn't plan for retirement. So in the trenches has a very different dimension for us than for this generation who, as you have indicated, you know, are feeling privileged in that these are just things of this age, of their generation. But when I thought about what I had to fight through, what we had to fight through in order to just sustain our core operation and to pay our staff, you know, we did not see the landscape of a retired experience. And now we're thinking about this when others are seeing it as an entitlement. We're just trying to get to the finish line. So, you know, that's...
When I was managing a dance company, we used to call unemployment, you know, drawing unemployment, where you laid the dancers off and they could rehearse. They couldn't perform, but they could rehearse. And we called that the biggest government support for the arts that there was. That was then.
It's true.
We do have quite a few questions. One relating to this issue of generations or skills or part-time and so on. If you're coming from, this question asks, if you're coming from a corporate job or a job in the corporate sector, is there a place to find work in the arts world? Is there a way to do that? In other words, if I don't have an arts background, you know, are you excluding me?
That's so interesting. I was interested to hear Grace, because I am 31 years old, and I have since I graduated college been
okay,
so.
We're leaving.
Sorry. Yes, I was born about the time that they started their careers, and I it's really interesting to hear you talking about MBAs and JDs, because I have, for the last 10 years, really grappled with whether I should be going back to school. And this, regardless of the fact that for being 31, I am, at least in the arts administration world, fairly high up. I've moved up fairly quickly. And I think the tension between kind of having an artistic sensibility to work in an arts organization and having a business acumen to work in an arts organization has been very problematic for me. And so, I mean, I guess I'm not answering the question. I'm more just saying I find it interesting.
I do think the reality on the ground is not about your passion, really. You know, when I talk about the fact that the field has much more requirements, there's greater rigor. And, you know, you do have to be able to account for the money that you take into the institution. So accountability is a critical issue. Being competitive, meaning being competitive with other organizations so that you get the resources, is an issue. So coming from a for-profit corporate sector, I would say you'd need to be prepared to make the transition. It's not an overlay. It's not a simple overlay. And it's not just transferable. There are some things that are very specific to the nonprofit cultural world that is not even the same in the social service sector. And so you really do need to understand this field in order to come into it. No one has the time to ramp you up. No one has the time to train you. We're all too busy in the trenches just trying to make sure that our staffs are paid.
So is there preparation that one could undertake in order to prepare to be part of the arts work world? How about, a lot of people recommend volunteering, you know, learn by volunteering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, when I worked at universities, I would often get this question from undergraduates about, I want to pursue a career in the arts, what should I do? So the first thing I would say is do not take an arts administration degree as an undergraduate.
Right.
Take an art. I don't care whether it's dance, music, theater, whatever it is, but take an art so you understand what it means to be an artist. You understand the ideology of art. You understand why people would dedicate their lives. I mean, we've been talking about administrators, but let's think about artists who don't have those kinds of structures, who have always been the most entrepreneurial people in the entire country, who have always had to have, who have risen and fallen on their ability to cope with a market-driven, neoliberal, capitalist society, doing something that doesn't fit any of those definitions. Get that. Before you start trying to run the organization, get that. Understand what that means. Mm-hmm. If you're not an undergraduate, if you're like shifting from, then yes, I would say, go spend some time with an artist. Go volunteer in an arts organization. Get inside and figure out what you're in for, because you're absolutely right. The values are different. And, you will get rewarded for things in an arts organization that you will get zipped for in a corporation and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't get that, you're going to be really unhappy.
Well, let me just add one thing. The thing that concerns me a little bit, even as I say get an arts administration or MBA degree, is what is happening with our young people now in terms of the student loans. And, just how hard it is. I mean, this is really a major conversation that needs to happen. And it's almost a catch-22. You need to have it. You should have it. But at the end of the day, you're going to be spending your entire life paying for that degree.
Right.
And hopefully the value added to your experience is that you will be making a good salary. But I will tell you that I started my career making $18,000 a year with a master's degree in art history from Columbia University. Mm-hmm. And so my career path has been, how do I pay that back? How do I pay my loans back from Columbia? How do I, so that was my driver. Passion, yes, for the arts, et cetera, but my driver was being able to pay back. And then, of course, being able to add value to my experience by applying what I had paid so much money for to something that could have some positive outcome and fulfillment for me personally. And so I would say that, yes, but be cautious. The economy is now driven by so many people who are not able to pay back what they've paid for. That, think smart, do volunteer work, go and get a certificate, but really be very thoughtful about spending $175,000 to go to the Wharton School of Business.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, one of the phenomena that we know it's happening is this sort of post-adolescence, that people are taking their entire 20s to figure out what they want to do with their life, which may not mean spending $175,000 on a graduate degree as you sort of figure out where it is. So when you reach the point that you're 30-something years old and now you're ready to really solidly get into that, then you have some knowledge about what you're getting into and some expectation that might be worth it.
Mm-hmm. And I think you have to pay attention to the skill set that's needed. I remember when we hired Clay's boss, to me the thing that really stood out on his application that made him a really viable person that I thought, I bet he could really handle this job, was he'd been a manager at Zuni's restaurant. Mm-hmm. And the restaurant business is a good place to get experiences very similar to the arts. Curtain goes up every evening, comes down every night. If people don't like it, they won't come back. We have reached the point in our program where we really only have time for one last question, and perhaps of the panelists, do you have another question you'd like to pose to your compatriots, or that you'd like to ask the audience, or the people sitting here today? Then I'll ask one. Artists who want to find work in an arts organization often wonder, well, do you want my degree? Do you want my degree, or do you want to see what I do, my body of work? What's more interesting or reasonable is if you see that I'm a good actor, or that I have a degree, or that my sculptures are wonderful, or that I have a degree, or that I learned the hard way about lighting design, or that I have a degree. What are you balancing?
Can I just, I just want to talk a moment about how we present or think about artists. You know, it's been, my entire career has been engagement with visual artists, at the Studio Museum. But at a certain juncture, I think we need to switch this notion that artists are not professional people or business people or whatever, that it's all just about the passion and the, there are artists who are professional people, so they are dual careers and all. So I think there's a nuanced conversation that really needs to take place that distinguishes, So when you talk about, artists as installers bringing them in, or you talk about, there can be an artist who is an educator working in your education department that also, kind of is engaged at all kinds of levels. So it's not such a defined or distinctive.
Yeah, I totally agree
answer
with
to that.
I think you really made an excellent point there. My sort of idea on that is that no artist survives without having some ability around the business part of it, right? They're variously good or bad or whatever, but they can't survive unless they have some ability about it. So I want to challenge us as people who run arts organizations to follow that same model and to see whether we have whether we can take the creativity and the innovation that artists have and apply that to this business model that we're struggling with, and see what we come up with.
Thank you. And on that note, I have to conclude our official part of the program today. Our thanks to Ken Foster, Clay Lord, and Grace Stanislaus for their really remarkably insightful comments today. We thank your audience sitting out there, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. The last question. I don't think
This is the question about degree versus practice?
Yes.
So are you talking about being hired as an artist or being hired not to make your art? To do something else. That sounded wrong, but you know what I mean. So we're a service organization, so we actually make no art at all. We support other people who make art, but our entire staff is made up of people who make art and who also are administrators. So in most cases, it's that they're theater artists. In some cases, it's that they do other things. When we look to hire someone, we do look for someone who is creative, but because they're going to be doing things that require business-related skills, we do need to make sure that they match. We're not in a position, the honest truth is that especially right now, we are not in a position to bet on a horse that might work. And so if we've got two people and one of them is an artist and also has a background that we think might be appropriate for this managerial job, then that person is going to win out over someone who is an artist, who is inspired, who has a great artistic resume, but doesn't have as strong a background in the particular managerial stuff that we would need.
I think it's a little bit axiomatic in the arts administration field that experience is the number one thing. So if I'm looking for a marketing director, I'm mostly interested whether you've been a successful marketing director at other organizations before you come to me. And your art or the practice of your art and the degree and your attainment of the degree is interesting, but it's not probably the deciding factor as to whether you get. It's a little bit of a false choice because there are so many factors that goes into the hiring.
What about when you're looking for an artist? Do you look more for the work that they've done or their education?
Okay, so for me...
Mounting shows?
Uh-huh. Well, there are two tracks, you know, when I think about what you're asking. On the one track, I would agree that you need to come skilled and ready, you know, because there's just the economy requires, you know, there's just a lot of options out there now, a lot of people with back, you know, with degrees. And so we've got a lot of folks to pick from. And at this juncture, that's one thing. But when it comes to, like, artists coming to the museum, for example, bringing their creative side of things. So, yes, we have artists who are installers and, you know, artists who come and make presentations as a part of our program. And we are looking for your creative input or output in the world as a part of the basis for inviting you to participate in our program. So it's not, we're not going to delve into your resume at that juncture and try to figure out if you've ever, you know, had a arts administration experience or exposure. We are taking you in how we intend to receive you and make you available to our audience. So that is bring your skills and bring your creativity and bring whatever else. But at that point, we're not looking for to hire you. We're looking to present you as a part of our program.
That's a big difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I'm, say, a mid-management or an associate director of marketing at a large institution, would you consider hiring me to be a director or the manager? In other words, if I want to move up, if I want to move up.
I have a quick story outside on that. So the managing director of one of the two largest theater companies in the Bay Area, I'll let you guess which. She was on a panel, and afterwards they were talking, and at one point she said, "You know, if I was leaving my job, and like my younger doppelganger, me 30 years ago when I started this job, walked in the door and said I want that job, I would laugh at them and turn them around and say that you can't have this job." Because the job, it's exactly what you're saying, the job has changed so much that the skills that she came in with when she started what has been an incredibly successful tenure at a variety of arts organizations culminating in where she is now are honestly probably not enough right now to be in the position that she's in. And that's been interesting to hear about. And that's one of the reasons why I personally have been grappling so long with this idea of getting an advanced degree, because I'm worried that somewhere in my future is a glass ceiling that takes the form of not having those extra letters after my name and the education that goes along with it.
And I personally, as former director of an graduate arts administration program, would say to people that they're are other ways of getting education than a degree. So it's not always the right path, and often it's way too expensive to do. There are ways to educate yourself and to find that information that can move you along in your skill set. Ken, you had a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, my background is in theater as well, and I was a theater director for many years, and so hiring people is like casting the show. I always have a vision in my head of exactly what it is that I want. No applicant ever fulfills it. And so when it comes down to it, I have to decide what do I think are the intangibles that the person is bringing that I can't teach, and what are the things that I can teach. So the fact that you don't know about, you know, X in the marketing field may not be a barrier if I feel that you have the creativity and the drive and the enthusiasm and the willingness to work as a member of a team and to motivate other people and all of those things that I can't teach. You either sort of have it or don't have it. Oh. That's kind of how I think about that. And the degree thing, I don't want to downplay the value of a degree, okay? Because I think there are certain things, particularly an advanced degree. I will certainly say I went after my master's degree because I was a teacher, and that's the only way you can get money is if you're is if you got an advanced degree. And then when I, by the time I got it, I quit teaching. It opened doors for me. It did not get me jobs, but it got me interviews. And particularly in the performing arts presenting world, everybody's got a bachelor's. Mm-hmm. Yes. Everybody has. Very few people have a master's degree. You heard I worked in all these educational institutions. It's the coin of the realm in higher education, even though it was not a requirement. So it definitely opened doors for me. There's no question about that. So in that sense, I think about that. I think Grace's point and about the money is a really important thing to think about. I just paid off my master's degree in the year 2000. Okay, so it was a long time. But to Clay, I would say, I didn't go till I was 30 years old. I didn't start till I was 30 years old, and I knew what I wanted, and I went after it, and I bought it, and I got it, and it worked. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, one last question.
I'm an artist, a performing artist. I came here, I guess I didn't understand this correctly. Well, maybe the focus was not on this area. As a performing artist, especially with YouTube and your Gwena and Moab, as an artist, what is the process you go through in which we look at you as places of performances? And what is your process? Because sometimes I see the same people, you know, doing the same thing, and you're not expanding it enough to bring in other artists of equal capabilities. So how does one, aside from, you know, building a tent in front of your place, go about
breaking in, it's called.
How do you break in? Okay. Well, let me say this, yes, my process. I can speak to that. Well, first of all, I referenced earlier on that MOED is a very unique institution. I mean, there is just no other institution in San Francisco that's has the mission focus that we have. And I preface my comment by saying that because that means that we get a lot of folks coming who want to participate with us, you know, rightfully so. We get to know all of the talent that's out there. And a part of what we need to figure out is how does this work in regards to our mission and our focus. But in terms of direct process, I simply, when I get the emails that's saying I've got a great exhibit, I have a wonderful book that I'd love to feature in the store, I'd love to do a performance, a dance, a music, you know, all of it. You know, I don't vet. This is not my role. I pass it on to our program person. And in the context of the conversations that I've had with the program staff, we've talked about what we are seeking, what we're looking for, what we're trying to achieve with a particular program. And so it's a simple matter of if you have a wonderful book that you've written, that you want to do a book reading at MOAD, the staff will simply read the book, you know, and figure out if the focus of it is related to our theme and the four core themes that we focus on, which you can find out about on our website. And then through her, you know, the decision is reached and the staff just simply discusses it. So we do have specific programs that you may be able to fit into. We have scholarly programs. We have book reading and book signings. We have our exhibitions program. Performing. We do all of that as well. We do all of that as well. So we've got the music programs, the music series. It's really a matter of getting in contact with our program person, Elizabeth Gessel.
I would just echo what Grace said. I mean, your question is, in my mind, is a curatorial question as opposed mm-hmm. to a job employment question, mm-hmm. right? So the whole curatorial process, we could do like 10 different sessions on that mm-hmm. in terms of exactly what Grace indicated in terms of the, we're just inundated, mm-hmm. inundated. In that sense, I'll agree with Rocco. A lot of artists out there that want to be presented at YBCA. So we too have curators. They review all of the material, all of the things that Grace said about the ideas, what it is we're trying to accomplish, whether or not that fits in. We look at a multi-year trajectory, who are artists that we presented before and why and what are they doing. We try to do new people as well mm-hmm. as try to sustain others so that artists feel like they have a, you know, you as an audience can see the development of an artist over a period of several years. It's really big and complicated. It isn't an easy question to answer. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. One more. Okay. Then we really need to. Oh,
two more.
Have I been ignoring you?
No, I mean, I'd like to ask a question, but if someone else has one too.
Okay,
I'm
and
hold
two, more. Two more. Okay. You, Barry, you and then you.
I have a BFA and an MFA, and I have a huge amount of debt, so I'm not looking into gaining more debt, but I would look into getting like some internship skills. I'm just wondering, like, a quick answer if you know of any like local institutions that do offer like similar
creative
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is, you can really educate yourself, you know, through the websites and online. You really can. Compass Point, certainly BridgeStar, you know, is another interesting. BridgeSpan, they have a lot of, you know, tools that you can download. There's lots of information. So all you need to do is really do a Google search, you know, and put in the right search words. And you can get the webinars, you know, and really just fully take advantage of, you know, their certificates, certificate programs, so you don't have to spend as much, you know, kind of increasing your skills. Foundation Center, they have a lot of programs as well. Yeah,
there's also an organization called the Bay Area Emerging Arts Professionals. It's both a support group for people who are trying to be arts professionals and kind of work in this incredibly expensive environment, and it also does occasionally offer like speaker series and classes. I don't think they offer actual certificate programs, but if you're looking just for kind of spot on education, that would be.
You can get a lot of professional development through going to conferences also. California Association of Museums or TCG or Arts.
Although all of those are very expensive too.
They can be.
Well, similarly, I've got 3 degrees, 2 masters, I mean, in the arts, and from various institutions, and not once have I heard them talk about this shift in needing, like, you know, kind of arts administration, like this focus of how to actually make it in, I mean, working within the arts. And so I'm curious, like, what advocacy is there to kind of explain? Because, I mean, you know, Ken, you're talking about, you know, from a different generation, you know, what your track was. Most of these schools are run by those who are in that same position.
Right.
And they're not necessarily seeing it themselves, and it's not implemented in the curriculum. Yeah. Is there anything out there that's actually really going out and kind of taking an advocacy to change that? Because I know it's not necessarily your objective. It's something that you have to contend with as well. Or is that message being brought to institutions teaching?
That's a good thing.
Institutions are really big, slow-moving things.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to hear you talk about change and both whether the institutions will be able to change the curriculum to reflect the reality and also whether the reality can change. I think that one of the things that is a kernel of truth, regardless of how you take Rocco Landisman's statements about supply and demand, is that you know, we had one job opening for an arts administration position, we had 100 applicants, and a lot of those people had master's degrees, and this wasn't even for something where they were going to be making art. Well, and it was. I mean, all of our salaries are incredibly low. Our managing director came out of the for-profit sector, and luckily has the means that she can take 1/9 of what she was making in the for-profit sector as her salary right now, and she's the second highest paid person at our organization. I think what is interesting to me, and also a little bit hard and heartbreaking, and maybe the reason that I engaged Ken on it, is that. I think that there is a reality that you do kind of have to cobble, and you have to be willing to allow parts of your life to be less core to you than other parts of your life, and that can be a very difficult choice to make, but that we're not in a situation right now. The honest truth is we're not in a situation where all of the artists that want to be completely supported by this community will be completely supported by this community, and so... And the thing to remember is that's true in every other sector in the world, and if you're in the for-profit sector, you do not get to just assume that you're going to get the promotion. You actually have to work, and there are intangibles that are associated with it, and all of that stuff. And so, and there's a huge amount of competition. So in a way, we're just kind of catching up.
Right.
But he's asking an interesting question, and that to me leads to something that could be a charge or a responsibility asked of service organizations, and that is how does the word get to those university program directors and chairs and so on? How do they understand more about the current situation? Who can get that to them? Foundation people? California Association of Museums? Arts presenters?
Well, I think it's I think it's a little unfair to say that they don't know what's happening. I think that there's a difference between them not knowing what's happening and them being able to articulate it sufficiently to teach you about what's happening.
If you look at the number of art schools and programs at various universities, not all of them, and I'd say they maybe have a minimum half, have arts,
an arts entrepreneurship thing or business skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Primarily focused on either a combination of education and studio practice.
You know, there is a little bit of a disparity. I mean, these programs, and I remember, and I did a little bit of homework before I came on this panel about the arts administration programs and when they were established, many in the early 1970s and a lot in the 80s. So when I was, going to school, I didn't really have a lot of access to any of that. And they framed up the discipline. I mean, the whole field of arts administration is a relatively new one. And in some ways, what you have now are, if you are in a good program, hopefully what you have are people who have been experienced in the trenches that can come back and give you the lived experience and the on-the-ground experience, but that will be something that you will still have to find for yourself. So they can give you, I can right now, take you into my classroom and give you all that you need to know about how to run a nonprofit organization, what the governance issues are, and the rest of it. And that's from the perspective of having lived it for these many years. But from the discipline and the practice and the approaches, that's kind of theoretical until you're in it. It's theoretical until you're in it. And so, hopefully you've gotten educators who at least can speak to real world stuff. And, a lot of these MBA programs, I did go, for example, I went to Wharton. They have an open house every month. And I just went to the open house to try. They prefer that you come in working, so they don't want you unless you're actually at a job already. And they prefer that you have a lot of experience on that job, that you're entrepreneurial. So there's a framework for all of this. So it depends to a certain degree on the school. It depends on who the teachers are, who your faculty, the faculty is, and their approach, and their thinking about this. So I think that there are two. There's a little bit of a disparity. You have to just be in the trenches. And how do you get that experience? Probably volunteer. You probably have to just put yourself in the mix with the 100 others that, we are doing a search right now for a director of development. And let me tell you that of the resumes that we've received, of the 25, let's say, resumes, and we've posted this in Craigslist and, Foundation Center and all of the usual vehicles, of the 25, there's probably 6 that actually has director of development experience. And this really speaks to the economy, it speaks to the reality on the ground. Most were sales and communication and PR, but everybody's now looking to how they can overlay, how they can bring their experience and kind of overlay it into this new framework and, apply the learnings. And, and there's a whole industry now on how to write good resumes, how to write good cover letters, and so I would say get in that. Find out how to frame up what you have and your assets and what's in your toolbox relative to what the field is needing and what that particular job is seeking from you. And there are lots of folks who can help with that, career counselors. I have a resume writer. She is redoing my resume so that it could, after 30 years, I want to get a sense of what. So there's a number of different things on a list that you can do, in terms of applying your degrees to the practical reality on the ground. It's a tough economy, and that's just the reality. But you have to think differently now, which means that you have to figure out what your true assets are in a very different climate and get some help in framing your stuff up, relative to what the field will allow and embrace.
I think I would just throw in There's an absolute national scandal occurring at this moment around for-profit institutions that are making money off of people enrolling and not finishing and not getting jobs. And many, many, many of those for-profit institutions are offering art degrees. And it's a national scandal. Huh. It's the absolute, it's even Doonesbury is writing about it.
Wow.
Right? Read Doonesbury in the paper.
Yeah.
We have to, we're way over time.
Thank you so much for coming.